54 times, and as a hill, 59 times. So around 600 times mountains or thereof are mentioned. And I would say that they're really important. Mountains are described as sources of springs and rivers and places of difficulty, of abundance, and destruction. They are places for the proud and for the haughty people. Mountains do tremble and are ancient and everlasting. And I think you might get the point of the importance of all the imagery and how abundantly and prominently they're featured in scriptures. From the Garden of Eden to Mount of Olives, we should stop and examine what the stories surrounding the mountains are trying to tell us. Culturally, both the ancient times as well as in today's cultures, in many cultures today, mountains are considered sacred spaces, places where heaven and earth meet, a place where man can meet with God. This is why Eden was considered a mountain, perhaps a spiritual one, but a place where Elohim met with his creation. Noah and the Ark landed on a mountain. Abraham faced one of his most difficult trials on a mountain. Mountains are where Yahweh reveals himself. He reveals his glory and his righteousness, as we saw in Exodus 19:18, when Sinai was completely engulfed in smoke and in a cloud, where Yahweh descended upon it with fire and thunder and the noise of a shofar. Mount Zion in Psalms 48 says that his mountain is declared holy, beautiful in loftiness, joy of the earth, the city of the great king. On Sinai, Yah declared his righteousness, his divine law, and his standard for all of his people. In Isaiah 2:2 and elsewhere, we find in the last days that the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountain. It will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. Mountains represent kingdoms, not just Yeshua's kingdoms, but with the kingdoms of the world, as we see in Revelation 13 and 17. Those will be destroyed at his return. Mountains are a place of worship and encounters with our Creator, as we see in Matthew 17 at the Transfiguration, as well as with Moses and Aaron and his sons and the elders and all of Israel standing there worshiping at the bottom of the mountain, as we see in our chapter today. Mountains are symbols and places of refuge and strength, places of protection. Just look at how God lifted Elijah into the mountain and not only kept him safe, but fed him there also. Mountains are a place of redemption and restoration, which is what we see in our Torah portion today in the Exodus story. This Exodus story is the main theme of the Bible. The types and the shadows, Joseph and Yeshua, and now in Moses and Yeshua, how Moses is calling and mountain experiences are shadowed of the same type of mountain experiences as Yeshua. Israel has now been redeemed, and they are going to be restored to a right relationship with their Creator, just as Yeshua does for us. And chapter 24 is confirming of the covenant. Moses had just laid out all the terms and the conditions and the promises, the warnings and the responsibilities of the people. Now is the time to ratify it with a ceremony through the blood of the offerings between the two parties. The drawing near of the priests and the elders, the bowing low, the prostrating of themselves, because I think we often think of being bowed as kind of like, you know, going in front of the king and the queen and doing the little curtsy and stuff. They didn't bow from the waist, nor did they take the knee, but they fully prostrated themselves to the ground. I don't think that many of us do that today. The people would have all witnessed this. They would have witnessed the worshiping and the bowing and the humbling of themselves. And I think that all eyes would have been on them 74 men. The statement, the message is, no one but those called can come before God. It is me and me alone, he says, that you should worship. The people would have been gathering and coming to the foot of the mountain anyway and staying there within the boundaries set before them. I've read where the people would have been camped in the same order at the camp at the base of the mountain as they did around the tabernacle, with separate spaces being for the people in the outer court, the priests in the holy place, and the high priest only into the Holy of Holies. The symbolism fits pretty well with how we know Yahweh sets his plans and how he intends us to see them. So we have the people here agreeing, and now the offerings. I'm not going to get into all the offerings and meanings, because I'd be here forever, and I'm trying to keep us on the short end of today. But we see the offering, the sin offerings done over the people and onto the altar. The Israelites themselves were to bring a friendship offering. First, these were the things, the way things were done in cultural times. But Yahweh sets everything new. He redeems everything. The new way forward, new promises. And now that they are a nation, they have a covenant with him and not with man. Just the Creator and themselves. As for Moses setting those 12 stones up, I'm going to give my opinion. I think they are a message to the people. These are like silent witnesses standing there before the people that represents his words and their words, we will do. Perhaps even bringing up in their mind the stone set between Jacob and Laban. That was the place where you just didn't cross. You didn't go back or forth. You stayed on your side of the stones. And these stones, I think, are the witness to those promises. And now they can't claim any ignorance of the law. They have to understand the terms. And I think that those stones would look upon those stones and they would see that they had represented themselves to God, saying, I will be your servant. I think one of the most interesting verses in the whole chapter is verses 9 and 10. Where Moses and Aaron and his sons and the 70 elders went up and they saw God. Absolutely saw God. I just don't know how it works. But they went up and the most comments made were about what they saw under his feet. So some of your commentary people will say that they didn't actually see God. They only saw the blue, the clear, beautiful blue under his feet. And we are told, I don't know how many times in the Bible that we cannot see the face of God without dying. It's just, I mean, it's everywhere. Moses only saw his backside. So how could those men have seen his face and not died? I just don't get it. But they were facing downwards, so the comments were about the radiance of his face. I mean, they were not about the radiance of his face, the brightness. And I would assume they would have this terror within them just seeing that. The comments are about the blueness, but the word here is the word ra'ah. It's strong 7200, and the emphasis isn't actually on the sight, like I am looking at you, but would be the presence was enjoyed, or they felt his presence, and they considered it, and they discerned it. That's what some think. Another thing, when Moses had been in his presence, his face shone like the sun. But these guys didn't come down the mountain with their face shining. That was weird to me. But anything is possible with God. Psalms 11:7 says that the upright shall see his face. And Psalm 17:15 speaks about seeing his face after death, at the time of the resurrection, talking about the coming, referencing the coming king and the resurrection of the dead. I honestly don't know, but they bowed to his glory and they bowed to God. And in the verse it says, and God did not raise his hand against them. So that's a little nod to the fact that they actually did see him. They probably didn't see him like I would see clearly your face, but they did see him because culturally, if the king waved you off, you were either carted off to prison or death. And that did not happen. And then they ate and drank while Moses and Joshua ascended the mountain at the request of Yahweh. So the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of God settled there for 6 whole days until Moses heard the call from Yahweh and was allowed in on that 7th day. And fire consumes the mountain. And then Moses remains up there for 40 days and 40 nights. That is a huge story in 18 verses. The Exodus way pattern, as I said before, will be repeated over and over and over again through this biblical story. People get themselves into promises, and God provides a way for them out of their bondage, a way out of the oppression they find themselves in. And then obviously we fall apart, and then we have to come back to him for saving again and again. Yet as we see, it's just not a get-out-of-jail-free card. God teaches us through each testing in our life That testing, those challenges, those are the things that teach us. They help renew our way back to Him, back onto His path, and the new life that He promises. In this new way of life, we find the chaos in our lives can be subdued. And you know, I can't say that the chaos is gone, because it's never gone. We live in this world, but we find that that chaos are teachable things for us. We can find solace on that holy mountain. We can find stability of the chaos in the world in His word, in His path. And today, we need a lot more stability than we used to. And Yeshua, He just offers that unconditionally. And as I said, the mountain experiences between Moses and Yeshua are just amazing. When we come to understand everything God does is to get our attention. He uses and uses and uses things over and over again until we look up and we see and listen. Just as the killing off of the gods of Egypt during the plagues, Yahweh uses the things that people are familiar with. And I would have to guess that most of the people would have been pretty familiar with the Exodus story to see the pattern in Yeshua's life. That, I believe, is why the apostles were continually saying that Yeshua is a greater prophet than Moses, that He is a greater high priest, that the renewed covenant in His blood is much better than the blood of the animals. Because I believe that the New Testament is the testimony of Yeshua, it is what the prophets foretold about Him, the promised Messiah, the promised Son of God, the one who restores all things, and He is the Savior to all mankind. He came not just to cleanse us, but everything, including the cosmos, which was also under the weight of sin. He is the prophet raised up, more worthy than Moses, as most of the apostles have stated over and over. John chapter 5 says, if you believe in Moses, then you would believe in Me because he wrote of Me. You know, I have to admit, I am obsessed with scriptures about mountains. I was talking to Pastor Mike last week, and he laughed at me. He thinks it's funny because I'm obsessed with how many times Moses went up and down that mountain. How tall was the mountain? How long did it take him? I would just, you know, those things, they're all connected in some way to our lives. So we find out that Moses goes up the mountain. It's mostly the mountain Sinai. And in these middle chapters of Exodus, so I'm going to lay a little disclaimer. I don't have it all figured out. I couldn't put everything in here. I could have gone on and on and on, just on two verses. But I had to stop. And then when I started the physical parallels between Yeshua and Moses, I had to stop around 25. Because then I would, you know, it makes you crazy. It literally makes you crazy when you keep finding all this cool stuff and you want to talk about it. But I had to stop. So, and to go along with that, and looking at Susan, I remember the first time I probably stood up here and talked, and I had three chapters in Deuteronomy, and I did the whole three chapters, and Susan, God bless her, comes up and says, oh, you did a great job, but maybe next time, you don't have to do the whole thing. So I've kept that in my mind, trying to keep it down to, like, you know, 40 minutes or something. Anyway, things like that really help you. So, as I said, I looked and I looked and I looked and I settled on these things. So, and I did use resources, and don't tell Mike this, but I used resources that are less than 100 years old. Okay, we all know how he feels about that. But not only there are physical types of parallels between Yeshua and Moses, but there are spiritual ones also. One of the ones that struck out to me was Moses calling out the 70 elders. Yeshua also calls out 70 as messengers. The 12 pillars are like the 12 apostles that are witnesses to His testimony and truths. The water from the rock was physical. Yeshua, being the water of life, is more spiritual. In Matthew 4, Yeshua is going to the mountain, and He's tempted with the kingdoms of the world. And Moses left behind the Pharaoh's court and all that brings because of the compassion he felt for the people. Here's a little another rabbit trail about the mountains. You know, the Sinai in our Exodus story, if you dig into it long enough, you're going to find out that people don't believe that this Sinai is the famous Sinai in the south central Sinai Peninsula, but the one in Midian. And I believe that it is the one in Midian, which is now Saudi Arabia. Exodus 18 has Moses in the land of Midian with his father-in-law. That would make the Sinai near the Gulf of Aqaba. In Arabic, it's called, the mountain's called Jebel Alaz. It's also named Mount Horeb, as well as Mount Sinai. So it has three names. It's the same mountain where Moses saw the burning bush, and it was called the Mountain of God. You know, it stands around 8,500 feet, making it quite the feat. Moses actually ran all the way to the top and back all those times. I don't think that he got to the summit every time, but at least he climbed it twice in chapter 19. I'm going, this guy has got more, I have more respect for this man than I ever did. I don't think I could ever get to the summit of that mountain. But I don't think that he went there every time. But, you know, anything's possible. He was an old man, but he was spry. But then, you know, Paul references in Galatians 4:25 that talks about where he went in the desert to the Gulf of Aqaba, the Mount Sinai. So I thought that was another witness to that. So there are 7 of the 8 times that Moses went up to the mountain. The first time, second time, and third time we find Moses going up and down is in chapter 19. Just as that old man, I have this vision of this old man with his big white beard and his cane, and he's walking up the mountain. But if you think about it, he probably walks a lot better than I do. So Exodus 19, 3 through 8 says, God calls Moses to him and tells him what to say to the people, and he's reminding them of what they had just gone through. And this was just 3 months after they left Egypt. So he goes up, goes down, tells the people, gets the answer, and he goes back up, telling Yahweh of the people's response. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that Yahweh heard those people. But being Moses, he had to be the mediator, and I think that a lot of times that some people need to hear things from other people, even though Yahweh's telling that to them through their prayers and stuff. So then as we see in Yeshua's transfiguration, being on the mountain doesn't change who you are, but reveals who you are. Moses was revealed to the people by his actions, by what he did, and Yahweh is always revealed by his actions. Exodus 20 and 25, it says that Moses gets the instructions for the sacred boundaries, where the people could go and not go, and what would happen if they disobeyed. And I did read that they were encamped much around, like the tabernacle, in a lot of ways following the same pattern, the same boundary patterns as the tabernacle, the outer court, and where the people could go. The fourth time Moses went up the mountains, he entered into the cloud, to the top of the mountain, into the darkness to receive the Torah. The fifth time is in our portion today, where Moses and the 73 went up to the mountain to eat the covenantal meal. The sixth time is also in our portion, where Moses went up the mountain to wait for Yahweh, to call him into the top of the mountain. He waited 6 days to enter, just sitting there. I can't imagine, I'd be bored. People don't have their phones either, so I don't know. So from the outside, from the base of the mountain, it had to look pretty ominous. You can see why the people thought that Moses was probably dead. 40 days and 40 nights without food. Maybe Yahweh fed him manna, I don't know. But it doesn't say he ate. He received the Torah and the design for the tabernacle and the structure for the service and the structure for how man could approach God. And then the seventh time was when Moses had to go back up the mountain and get new tablets. He did go up to Mount Nebo to meet God one last time before he died. Turning to Yeshua 7 times going up the mountain, and everything that I'm going to take is from the book of Matthew. Matthew is the retelling of the Exodus, I believe. I was listening to a Messianic rabbi several years ago. He's got a book out, and that's how he came to believe in Yeshua, because he read the book of Matthew. He said, well, this is a Torah book, you know? So I was really impressed with that. And I, let's see, now I'm being like Mike. I can't figure out where I am. Okay. The gospel revolves around what Dina Dye, one of my favorite authors, calls the cosmic mountain. She describes these encounters through the lenses of enthronement, Matthew's retelling of the mountain episodes in a relationship to the divine kingship, unlike anything Moses could have ever aspired to be. Moses fit the idea of a warrior king. Man needs to be rescued, but Yeshua is the ultimate king, the only righteous one, something Moses could never achieve. In Matthew 4:8, Yeshua is taken to the top of the mountain, tempted and offered the kingdoms of the world, an offer he rejected. Just as Moses rejected a false king in the Pharaoh and all the false power and wealth that provided. Matthew, from chapters 5 to 8, is the Sermon on the Mount, echoing Moses' teaching at Sinai. Not so much Moses' teaching, but what God taught him. Yeshua ascends, he sits, and he teaches. And now he has the label of rabbi. He's teaching them what I call Torah 2.0. Not something written on a tablet, but something written on the heart. Something that was a very radical idea. Transforming the heart, put his word there, not annulling the Torah, but ratifying it and opening it up to everyone. He not only, He not only not had a Torah scroll to read from, but he was restoring what we might think of the ethical ways, pointing out all of the wrongs presented within the temple and the leadership, and putting weight to the Torah, giving it meaning, instead of just showing up 3 times a year and doing what the priest and the other teachers tell them to think. What he was doing, I firmly believe this, was arming the apostles and those who sat there that took his words to heart, arming them with a combat manual, if you will, built on love, not force, just as the Israelites learned during their exodus, that they were there by choice. None of them were compulsed to be there. Love is the weapon. Love of God first, your family, your community, wherever you find yourself. That was certainly a radical vision for the times and the cultures. As we move to the third mountain experience in Matthew 14:23, the feeding of the 5,000, I see this as mimicking the manna in the desert. God is the only provider, and Yeshua, as the bread, lifts up the bread for the blessing, intercessing for the people because they were hungry. Moses is often found in the tent of meeting or on the mountain praying, intercessing for his people. And then in Matthew 15:29-39, on the mountain near the Sea of Galilee, Yeshua goes to the Gentiles, to the people that were supposedly not his. No longer is Israel a little piece of people, not just Judeans or Torah-observant people or the descendants of Jacob, as they were called at the mountain. But now they are called to the mountain as all people. He takes this his word to the pagan lands, if you will. And everybody's in need of saving. Those Israelite cities, no one sitting there didn't need to be saved. They were lost, they were scattered, and they were waiting to be found wherever we are. So I think that opening up the on that mountain, sitting there, there wasn't just Jewish people sitting there. There wasn't just Judeans. There were Gentiles. There were people coming from all over the place willing to listen to this man, this really cool guy. I can see him being an influencer on TikTok these days. So, but can you imagine in Matthew 17 standing there on that mountain watching that transfiguration? I can't imagine seeing the glory of God right there in front of my face. I mean, we see the glory of God in all kinds of things, but to see that, I would have fainted right then and there. But the people were seeing Moses' face shining because he was in the presence of Yahweh, Yeshua's face. What happened? It shined like the sun. His clothes were ablaze in light. He was radiant. He is the radiance. The glory came from within and not from without, as we saw with Moses. And that wasn't enough to take in. Suddenly, God speaks from the mountain, from that cloud, and he says, "This is my son whom I love. I am well pleased, and listen to him." Again, I would have passed out. Just to hear that voice, you know, we all want to hear the voice of God, but are we really prepared to hear the voice of God? I think it's just kind of a scary proposition when you're not ready for it. But this goes back to what I was saying before. Going up the mountain reveals who you are. It doesn't change you, although those trials that we find getting into the mountain, those big boulders that fall in our way, they change us on many levels. But at the core of it, the trials reveal the truth of who you are. In Yeshua's case, it reveals that he was the Messiah, that he actually is the Son of God promised. Then the sixth mountain ascent becomes the mountain of judgment, of lament, and of sadness. We find this story in Matthew chapters 21 through 24. The Mount of Olives began the royal possession into Jerusalem. As Yeshua started through the path to his death and resurrection, he mourns the state of things. He says, "If you only knew, if you only would see." Yeshua then takes his disciples to the mountain to teach them. And we call this the Olivet Discourse. Yeshua speaks of the times ahead, of the destructions that will come. He is warning them of the judgment and the consequences that follow. The spiritual rot that was present reminds that the boundary stones have been removed and nothing was holy anymore. But there was a new house coming, one from all tribes, all nations, all people, and they were going to go out and teach them Torah 2.0. The house that was built on love, on faith, the foundation that will never be torn down. It was and is, and we are the temple and the priesthood. Yeshua builds this house by renewing what was set in stone at Sinai, renewing it in with people who have clean, willing hearts, building it on the faith that shines not just on the outside, but from within. Yeshua doesn't tear the mountain down. He cleanses it. He renews the landscape. He renews the meaning and reminds us that the meaning of Torah is all about love and mercy and grace, as willing to learn to love your neighbor as yourself. That's the hardest part of the whole Torah, learning to love your neighbors. The renewed contract, if you choose to accept it, go to Jerusalem, and I'm going to send you a gift that will help you know Torah, who will teach you, who will be your boundary stone if you will go against the onslaught of the world that comes against his ways. We know that this is the Spirit of God, the Ruach HaKodesh, the tongue of fire that rests within us. It's like that tongue, that the fire that rests on top of the mountain. The tongue of fire rests inside our heart, helping us to move forward. And in Yeshua's, in the seventh time he goes up into the mountain, is in 28:16-20. It's his coronation and his commission. He rises as a king into the heavenly places, and he leaves them, and he takes what they have learned on that mountain and on the roads traveled with him, telling them of the love of God and all of those promises. Unlike Moses' eighth trip to the mountain experience, where it ended in death, Yeshua's will end in life. We know Yeshua will return, and he set his feet on the mountain, and the world will come to bow and worship and serve and pray tribute to him. We all talk about our desert trials, our desert exodus from the world ways to to his ways. But let's not forget the awesome examples of the mountain experiences. God is everywhere. We can experience him daily because of the indwelling of his Ruach. Psalms 24 asks, "Who can ascend the mountain of God, who may stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not trust in an idol or swear by a false god." And then it continues with blessings for those, for all of those things. It's about knowing and worshiping the King Yeshua and his God and our God. The mountain of God is where I want to be. I want to surrender myself each step of the way that reveals not just who I am becoming in him, but my love for him. I know that I cannot stand in the presence of the Almighty this side of the kingdom, but I can meet his mediator, his son on his holy mountain. even if it is a spiritual one, because face it, who of us can walk 8,500 feet upon a mountain? That's a big ascent. I'd have a stroke on the way up. But we do have access to him, do we not? I want that order that he provides in my life because he's the only one that can give it to me. What I've learned these past few weeks studying these mountain scenarios is God is never distant. He's waiting, he's watching, and he's waiting for us to heed the call. He chose to dwell among us. He descended right into our hearts. Hebrews 12, 18 to 22 says, "You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast or such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged them no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, 'I am trembling with fear,' but you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to a thousand upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names were written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirit of the righteous made perfect, to Yeshua, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks of a better word than the blood of Abel. See to it that you do not refuse who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will be if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven?" We don't necessarily have to climb mountains to hear him speak. But remember, Yeshua created sacred spaces in our gatherings, on our Sabbath gatherings, where we all come in his name. He's there. Being in the presence of God is being in the sacred space. Our gatherings together on Shabbat, on the feast, and family meals are not just social gatherings. They are sacred spaces set aside to worship him. What a day it's going to be when we meet him on that mountain as we return to finally see him face to face. But as we go about our days and climb those mountains and live in some sort of those valleys, remember, we're supposed to take what we learned on that mountain and bring it to others. The world is in grave need of his light. And that only comes from God. And we do all this because it is our commission to follow the path of Yeshua, shake things up by loving and doing, by fulfilling the knowledge of our King and our Savior, and to keep those sacred spaces holy. Shabbat shalom. I